Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, investigative reporter David K. Johnston, has been covering Donald Trump since 1988. Last year, he wrote a bestseller called The Making of Donald Trump. He's out with a new bestseller called It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David K. Johnston argues that political termites have infested our government, and they are destroying it from within by compromising so many issues: jobs, the climate, safety, finance, and more. Instead of looking out for the forgotten Americans as he promised, Donald Trump is using his presidency to further enrich the wealthy and dismantle government. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. They focus on what politicians do rather than what they say. David is the author of many bestsellers. He'll be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club, 110 The Embarcadero in San Francisco. The event is sold out, but you might want to see if they're going to release tickets, and they will probably be live on Facebook. We're actually also live on Facebook if you want to check that out. And David K. Johnston joins me in studio. Hi, David. Nice to see you.
Delighted to be here again, Rose.
Well, thank you for coming back to talk about your new book. Before we started, you said the one thing that really bothers you right now is that so many people are cynical about Trump. They think they know what he's doing, but when you talk to them, they really don't know what he's doing.
Even if you've been very assiduously following the news, you know, you get up every morning and say, I'm going to read every article in the New York Times and the Washington Post and Bloomberg and Politico. You don't know what's in my book because they're all covering the tweets and the palace intrigues. And that's important. And I think the reporting on the from the White House has been vastly better than I ever imagined it would be. The diligence and the creativity of my peers has been terrific in this, as, in contrast with the election where the campaign, they really screwed up miserably. But nobody's out there really covering the government. What's going on that affects you, your income, your safety on the job, your children's health? And bad things are going on. These termites are in there. Trump, now understand, Donald Trump doesn't do this himself. He's a lazy guy who puts in a five-hour day, and that is includes lunch. But the people he brought in with him, they are determined to destroy the American government. And you and I are going to suffer for this because some damage can be undone right away. Some is going to last long after my time runs out.
Let's talk about who's actually making the decisions. The New York Times had a piece recently about the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation says that Donald Trump has embraced about two-thirds of its agenda. They've got a long list of what they want accomplished, and Trump is doing a lot of it. In fact, they're saying it even succeeded the first year of Ronald Reagan. And then if you look at Mike Pence, who is closely connected to the Koch brothers, he gave the keynote at the Koch conference last year. There's a ton of articles about this. Is it Pence or is it Koch? Who's really calling the shots? When you look at Donald Trump, David, who is advising him? Because you write about, in your book, about the close connections with Steve Bannon. Do you think Steve Bannon, does he still have the ear of Donald Trump? Is that fight real or not?
If he doesn't, he'll have it back. I mean, Donald has lots of on-and-off relationships. He's been on and off with Roger Stone, the evil wizard of Nixonian politics, for decades. But, you know, Donald is heavily influenced by the last person he spoke to. That's why you see him, you know, agree to something with Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi, and then an hour later, what are you talking about? Yeah. Because the man has no principles at all. He has no moral scruples. He has no philosophy except Donald Trump. The magnification and glorification of the genetically superior, world's greatest memory, except when I can't recall, Donald Trump.
So you think that he just says what the last person, how the last person influenced him.
Yeah.
So he'll tell Feinstein, yes, we'll give you a clean DACA bill. But then the Republicans next to him say, no, we're not doing that.
That's right. And he doesn't study and learn things. You know, in the previous book, I gave examples from his own mouth of where there are just simple, basic things that he doesn't know, or where he is asked a question he doesn't know the answer to, that most of us would go, oh, well, I don't want to have that happen again. And he gives the same answer months later. So it's important to understand that it's the people Trump brought in who are doing these things. And what we are seeing is what the ancient Greeks called a kakistocracy, a government by the worst people, the most venal, the most corrupt, the least qualified. And those folks are pursuing, you know, for example, the Heritage Foundation agenda is a very good example of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to live in a country that is government of, by, and for the rich, and you will get just enough to not be rioting in the streets because your children are starving, hey, you should embrace the Heritage agenda because you'll get it.
This Times piece says that as 8 years of a Democratic administration drew to a close, Heritage began developing a list of 334 policy prescriptions that a new administration could adopt. Things like reimposing work requirements for welfare recipients, ending the program that shields young immigrants brought here illegally as children, withdrawing from the climate accord, eliminating gender identity protections. Why does the Heritage Foundation care about trans issues, for example?
Well, within Heritage, you've got to build a coalition of people. And, well, the, you know, Heritage had its roots in the Powell memo that Lewis Powell wrote when Ralph Nader was the most popular man in America a long time ago. Mm. Lewis Powell, a lawyer in Richmond, Virginia, was hired by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to write a memo about what do we do? Corporate America was terrified of the consumer laws and things that were being passed. And he wrote, you can go on the internet, just put in Powell memo, a brilliant, brilliant plan. Bring the journalists to heel. Destroy the unions. Make a totally business-friendly environment, not a people-friendly environment. And you know, I don't so much like left-right. Mm. I like to divide people. There are the peopleists and there are the corporatists. And those folks, they are definitely the corporatists. Mm. But to build their coalition, yeah, they've also got to deal with people who say, well, yeah, but I hate gay people. I don't want to consider transgendered people. And if they're out there, but I don't want to do anything for them. So that becomes their coalition.
And the evangelicals have a seat at the table.
Yes.
So Heritage said 64% of those items have been enacted already, either through executive order or another means of enforcement. In Reagan's first year, it was about 49%. When you talk about political termites, David, what would you say, what person in the cabinet concerns you the most, and who are you following closely?
Well, the termites are the people you don't see. They're like, you know, you don't know termites are eating up your house until you put your foot through the floor one day and discover, you know, you have to tear the house down or have a huge bill to repair it. So it's not the cabinet people that I'm talking about in that term. It's people who were appointed for 130 days under the law to be temporary government executives. And we need to have a law that does that. You know, the person you've never heard of as deputy assistant secretary in charge of whatever has a heart attack or has to quit suddenly for some reason. You need to be able to replace somebody. But, you know, we have now entered season two of Trump, the White House reality show. 130 days was a long, long time ago, and a bunch of these people are still in place. And they're in all the departments. One of the worst, most awful examples of that is Scott Pruitt at the EPA. Mm-hmm. I tell, you know, I do my stories through telling you about what happened to people in the government, and I tell about Betsy Sutherland. She's a longtime senior manager on water issues at the EPA, and she was used to having previous EPA administrators, you know, all the way back to Christy Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, come by her office and say, well, this industry or that is complaining about a proposed rule or the way we're enforcing the law, and, you know, let's talk about what's reasonable and what we can do or can't do. Pruitt's people, they never do that. They, in fact, locked the doors, keep people at a distance, make you leave your cell phone if you're summoned to come in, and they ordered her to have her whole team do very detailed reports, extremely detailed reports. And what were they on? Disclose every single weakness in trying to enforce the Clean Water Act. Mm. And what do you think happened to those documents? I mean, they won't tell us, but, you know, they went to the polluters. Of course they did.
You write that in her farewell address to 120 EPA clean water staff, Betsy Sutherland expressed her frustration at Pruitt's actions to undo regulations, including the slurry pond rules, and her fear of what they will mean for public health and safety and the environment. She was especially troubled that Pruitt showed no balance, always taking the side of the polluters.
Always. And the slurry pond rules, which may not mean something to people, when you burn coal, remember, we love clean coal. We love clean coal. When you burn coal, ground down finer than face powder for makeup, it still leaves a toxic residue. There's cadmium and mercury and other heavy metals in it. Traditionally, for more than 100 years, electric power plant owners would wash it down with a hose and create a slurry, a sludge, put it into a toxic pond. Typically, these ponds being downhill from the plant were right next to the rivers we get our drinking water from. And we've had several incidents in the last 5 years of the dikes collapsing, because some of these are 100 years old, ruining the water for everybody, at least for months, killing all the fish. And there are better modern ways to deal with this toxic residue, but not this administration. It's like, hey, go back to using slurry ponds, a technology from 100 years ago. Because it's cheap.
In your book, we learned that Sutherland said the best case scenario is that citizens will have to pay the bill to clean up the messes that polluters leave. The worst case scenario is that those messes just don't get cleaned up and future generations will have to live with the health consequences.
Right. So one of the really evil aspects of this, and I do mean to say evil, is nobody will die tomorrow from asthma or cancer or heart disease because of what they're doing. But, you know, I have grandchildren, a few of whom are now young adults. They and my great-grandchildren, they're the ones who over years, if they live downstream from these things, some of those people, not all of them, are going to develop diseases they did not need to develop. And why? So the owners of electric power plants can make more money. And you know who owns most of the electric power plants these days? It used to be, you know, PG&E used to be the biggest utility in America. I've written about utility regulation for almost 50 years and taught it at a law school. They're now owned by Wall Street firms. So remember Donald Trump ran against Wall Street? Yeah, right.
On this issue specifically, David, there are new outlets like Inside Climate News. Well, it's been a couple years now, but really good outlets doing great work. Where are you looking specifically for good reporting on environmental issues?
Well, that's not how I do it. What I do is I go to the Federal Register, which is the government's official rule book. It's published every day, and the Congressional Record, and then various websites. And when I need something on the environment, even though my first National Investigative Reporting Award was for environmental coverage, 45 years ago, you probably would hire a freelancer that I know to do work for me. And one thing about 40% of journalism jobs going away, I don't have trouble finding talented people who I can hire to do legwork. Sad. It is absolutely awful for our democracy. But you know, Climate Change News does good work. There is a website that is ballyhooed today at the Columbia Journalism Review, CJR.org, where climate scientists put up their reviews of journalist coverage of environmental issues. And I took a look at it, and it looks quite substantial. And on economic news, Dean Baker, who's a liberal economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, does a daily Beat the Press blog that I look at every day because – you know, I've worked financial journalism the last 15 years of my newspaper career, and every day I read stories in the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. in the New York Times, and the Washington Post, where I go, well, that reads like a wonderful, make-sense story, and the reporter obviously understands zero of the economics because it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking today with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He runs a nonprofit news service, DC Report, focusing on what politicians do rather than what they say. His newest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, now on the New York Times bestseller list. Also, it's a bestseller in Germany.
Yes, and it's in the German language version, which is called Trump in Amt, Trump in Office. And it's on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. Hmm.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for David, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on social media. We're on Facebook Live or Twitter at Your Call Radio or our website. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You just brought up the economy, so let's talk about taxes, David. You were a tax reporter. You won prizes for your reporting at the New York Times. You were on a couple months ago to talk about the tax bill. Now that it has been signed, what strikes you about it? I mean, Trump keeps saying that we are all going to see some money, we're going to get money back, and we're going to get dividends. I mean, what does this even mean?
Well, this is one of the most politically brilliant things I've seen in years. You know, the 90% of Americans had a smaller income in 2012 than in 1967. And then in 2013, during Obama, incomes began to rise for the bottom 90%. Not enough to make up for all those years, however, and people legitimately feel horrible pain and are aggrieved. They may not understand why, but they just know, I don't have enough money. A lot of people are now going to start next month getting $10, $20, $30, $40 a week more in their paycheck. That'll be important to them. $10 a week, $500 a year. But here's what is in the bill that was completely misreported. I'm sure you read, Rose, that Apple is paying $38 billion in taxes because of profits offshore, profits it mostly earned in America and siphoned out of the country as interest-free loans from the government. And wouldn't it be nice if the government had loaned you all that money with paying taxes before you get your paycheck at zero interest? Well, Apple didn't pay the money. The newspaper reporters listened to Apple, and they didn't read the bill. The bill says you get an 8-year extension of your zero interest loan, and you pay it off 8% this year and 8% next year, and then in 2025, you pay the last 25% of the bill at zero interest. And by the way, they don't have to bring the money back to America. What they got was the right to bring it back, and the actual tax rate they're paying was cut from 35% to 15%. I mean, what a sweetheart deal. You get your tax rate cut, you get your due date extended at zero interest. Wow, I would love to have that deal. I just don't see Congress giving it to you and me.
Can you elaborate on Apple? Because the way that it's being framed in the United States is, I'll just read a headline from The Verge. Apple commits to contribute over $350 billion into the U.S. economy over the next 5 years. The New York Times, and this is this month, Apple, capitalizing on new tax plan, plans to bring billions in cash back to the United States. And this is celebrated by Trump. He said, great to see Apple follow through as a result of tax cuts. Huge win for American workers and the USA!
Apple had, before this bill came along, committed to, I don't remember the exact number this morning, but I think it was $275 million of that money. Basically, about close to 90% of that money was going to be spent anyway. Similarly, when ExxonMobil announced it was going to spend $200 billion over 10 years on capital improvements, they had already budgeted, and it was in their disclosures, that they were doing $180 billion of it. You know, this is just Donald Trump relies on the fact that other people are enumerate. He's enumerate, too, by the way, terribly enumerate. But people, you know, people who read and write just fine, many of them, they don't do numbers.
Who actually benefits from Apple bringing back $350 billion to the U.S.?
Well, there's no requirement that they use it in any specific way. So Apple could decide to build a factory here. Kind of hard to imagine when you've got virtual slave labor from Foxconn in China and some people committing suicide to escape their circumstances. They might expand their design operations and hire more software programmers here in America. But they could also use it to buy back stocks. And that increases the value of the options given to the executives because there's less stock in the market. And another thing they can do is, if they're very conservative, they can take their interest-free loans and buy U.S. debt. The government's about to sell over the next 10 years $1.5 trillion more debt than it would have to finance the tax cuts, which means not only do they get an extension of their zero-interest loans, but you're going to be taxed to pay the interest that they're going to collect by investing the proceeds of their zero-interest loans. Want to know why Apple's so rich and you're not? I just explained it to you. And I say this as somebody who, I have an Apple phone in my house. I have 5 or 6 Apple computers. I bought my children, 8 of them, all Apple computers. I mean, I've spent many tens of thousands of dollars over the years on Apple.
What else do you think deserves more attention about the tax bill? You have reported about how the George W. Bush tax cuts have affected us. How will these tax cuts affect us in years to come?
So in the short run, there's a stimulative effect from this tax bill because people are going to have more money in their pocket when we adjust their take-home pay. And that generally will start next month. A few employers doing it already. On the other hand, when the Bush tax bill was passed, and it was in design largely along the lines of this one, huge cuts for people at the top and crumbs for people at the bottom, we went through 8 years, in fact 10 years, in which the population of this country grew five times faster than jobs, and wages were flat for everybody who isn't talent. Everybody who was under $75,000 a year, wages were entirely flat, and they were pretty flat for people under $1 million a year. So we may well see a slowdown. And look, we've got an expansion of the economy going on since July of 2009, a few months after Obama took office. Job growth resumed in March or April of 2010. Job growth has slowed down since Trump took office. We would expect that. As you're nearing full employment, it would slow down, but it's significantly below. The rate of growth of the stock market, which is way overpriced at the moment, is slowed down. So what's Donald going to do when suddenly there's a negative number on job growth? We lose jobs some month. When the stock market falls, if you're going to keep claiming credit for bringing the stock market up, when it falls, you're going to have to take the blame for it. And I can tell you what he'll say. Fake news.
Well, this is not fake news. When I hear reports about job growth or job creation, the thing that always gets me is we never hear about what kinds of jobs those are. And the Washington Post had a great piece in November. The fastest growing jobs in America pay about $22,000 a year. It's domestic workers, home workers, health aid. The health aid industry is exploding.
It's the servant economy.
Right. And it's about 21 grand, 22 yeah. grand a year.
If you go back to the year 1900, the much smaller middle class in America had servants. And that's why when you look at many of the houses built in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they have two staircases and they have bathrooms up above. That's where the servants lived. And I did a story years ago in the New York Times pointing out that based on published reports from the 1890s, a family cook in New York City in 1890 was better off financially than a McDonald's cook in, I think this was 1996, because they got fed, they got room and board, and they got a little salary. And the McDonald's person has to get a Subway to work and has taxes taken out of their check, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to see more of this servant economy, and we're seeing this divide that is spreading for reasons that have little to do with Trump or Obama or any other president. Mm. The economy is changing. The industrial economy for 200 years created jobs because of inefficiency. When steel was invented over 2,000 years ago, it took person years of labor to make one ton of steel, and tribute from a vanquished king was often paid in steel. That's the running thing in Game of Thrones, Valyrian steel. Mm-hmm. Now it takes 40 minutes of labor to create a ton of steel. Those jobs are not coming back. Manufacturing jobs are not coming back. And so we're going to see more of a servant-type economy.
Today we are speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston about his new best-selling book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David wrote another bestseller last year called The Making of Donald Trump. And in this book, he writes about how this administration is undermining government and affecting so many issues, finance, climate change. After the break, we'll continue talking about the economy and the dismantling of worker safety protection. David says that a lot of people think they know what's happening with Trump, but when you dive deep and look at who's really making these decisions, it's not getting as much attention as it deserves. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be talking about the bombing and the violence and the devastation in Afghanistan. And we will also talk about the latest with the FISA memo. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter, you can give us a call at 866- 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on social media. David's new book is a bestseller. It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David, one more question about the status of workers. So if jobs are paying 21, 25 grand a year with no benefits, so many people are now independent contractors. They do not have benefits. They do not have retirement. They do not have security. So many things are being automated. You know, you're in San Francisco right now. You see that our homeless crisis has exploded.
Not the San Francisco I knew as a boy.
Exactly. What are we doing? Where is this going?
Well, we have fundamentally, since Ronald Reagan took office, and we abandoned the New Deal. We have been increasing the amount of benefit from owning capital and lowering labor. The federal government does something called returns to non-farm labor. The returns to the economy, the gains, can only go two ways. They go to capital or they go to labor. And if you look at the chart, since 1980, you will see, with a few exceptions, a downward trend. And in fact, the newest report shows another downward dip that means capital is getting more and labor is getting less. Month-to-month data has got a lot of noise and not real important. But the trend line is very, very clear. We got rid of unions. When 37% of private sector workers belong to unions, 80% of workers benefit. And, you know, I've been the head of a union, and I founded with one of my sons a company where I have employees. So I've been seeing both sides of this. We didn't have a union, but I would have been perfectly happy to have one. But without unions, Pope Francis says, there is no economic justice. Our competitors have unions. And as a result, workers negotiate to get a larger and reasonable share of the value that they add. Productivity has been going up, but wages have not, because workers, unless you're a name brand talent, you have no bargaining power.
Now, when we ask you, what do? You say vote. Okay, voting's important. But we're at a point where the Democrats really aren't even talking about unions.
No.
Right?
And you know, look, the Republicans are real clear that their agenda is quite clear. The reason we don't have enough jobs and they don't pay enough is the rich don't have enough money to invest and pay for the talent. And the Democrats, I don't know. What is the economic plan of the Democratic Party? I hope Nancy Pelosi is listening. She's probably not, because she's in D.C. today. But, you know, please start articulating what you're for. We know you're against Trump. Good for you. He shouldn't be in the presidency. He's a terrible mistake. But start telling us, what are you for? Start doing what Donald did. Throughout the campaign, everywhere he said, I love you. We love you. You know, we care about you. We love our police. We love our clean coal. You know, and get away from blah, 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 blah.
Well, the unions put these presidents, Bill Clinton, Obama, in power. They spend so much money on Dems. And what do they get in return? These Dems are not passing any labor law reforms.
Right. They're taking away and taking away and taking away. I speak to a lot of unions and a lot of business groups. And the union leaders I know, and I've spoken to the heads of four international unions in the last couple of weeks, they all say to me, you know, when you come, can you talk about what do we do for all our members who think Trump is our savior? Mm. And that's what my talks will focus on is, you know, how do you explain to people that he's not your savior? He's a con artist.
Before we get to calls, you write also about the dismantling of worker safety protections under Trump. You write about a corporate safety officer in Minnesota who says production is more important than safety, despite the fact that catchphrases are being thrown out like safety is number one or safety is a priority. Management puts employees' health and safety on the back burner. That is why OSHA is needed.
Right. So about 4,800 people a year are killed on the job. Everything from accidents and falls, electrocutions, being crushed, vehicle accidents when you're at work. To shame those employers who used bad practices, and that's not many of them, but that's why you have rules. The federal government under the Obama administration put up press releases to shame these companies and get attention to their bad practices in the hope that they would improve, because the fines are killing a worker are insignificant to most companies. Well, the Trump administration stopped posting those. Now, we wrote about that at DC Report. They then put them back up. I can't connect that it was causal, but it is the order of events that happened. Now they've stopped doing it. They stopped posting worker deaths. Every worker death used to be posted. You see the name of the person, who they work for, et cetera. No more, not since August. And now asked for, let's just have statistical information. How many people were electrocuted? How many people were crushed? No, you can't have that. this is going to lead to employers on the margin cutting corners and more people dying. But, you know, we've reported at DC Report, a couple of specialized labor places have reported it, Jordan Barab in particular. But, you know, where's the big nightly news coverage on the networks? Where is the front page story in the New York Times and the Chronicle and the Sacramento Bee?
Well, we have a question from a listener about journalism. Let's hear from Bill in New Mexico. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Yeah. My question for Mr. Johnson is, I know that you mentioned just a few minutes ago about the 40% decline in journalism employees, professional journalist jobs. And I just wanted to ask you if you agree with David Simon, the creator of The Wire, who was a Baltimore Sun beat reporter before he became a television producer, that it is this decline of the beat reporters, particularly at the city halls, at the state capitals, etc., that in many ways is the biggest threat to progress and to our democracy going forward, and that, you know, the likes of Facebook in particular, with the way that they have just basically siphoned the profits out of the newspapers, has, you know, this is arguably the biggest threat to our democracy going forward. I think David Simon said that if he were to go in, a growth business in the future would be municipal fraud and chicanery.
Yeah. Well, Phil, I wrote a chapter in a British book called Investigative Journalism, Dead or Alive, about this, I think, 5 or 6 years ago now. And I'm the former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. And consistently what I've said is investigative reporting is doing okay. I mean, I'd like to see 10 times more of it, but we're doing okay. But beat reporting is just disappeared. The city that I live in now, Rochester, New York, rarely does the newspaper have a reporter at the county legislature, which is what we call it there. My school board, never. You know, my town that borders Rochester, never. The city council of Rochester, which is about 220,000 people, once in a while when there's something that matters, its beat reporting is gone. The situation in Bell, where the city manager was getting $800,000 and the police chief $500,000, and Bell's a little poor blue-collar suburb of L.A. with about 36,000 people, they did it all in the open, because there were no journalists covering it. And yeah, this is the kleptocrat's dream. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see a lot more corruption in local government over time because of this. Some of it will get caught. All of it won't. Remember, most criminals never get caught, never get arrested.
Just recently, over the last couple of days, I'm reading here from the East Bay Express, buyouts and layoffs hit East Bay Times and other Bay Area news group papers. A total of 28 journalists accepted buyouts and layoffs are scheduled for next week.
Yeah, and here's how different the world is. In 1976, when I was hired to be a national investigative reporter here in San Francisco for the LA Times, I got chastised for flying coach. You know, national correspondents fly first class and stayed in the best hotels and, you know, and now, you know, you'd be lucky to get bus fare to go across town. Mm. There's no money. And Google in particular, when I was at the New York Times, I went to this meeting where they said, well, you know, Google's helping with their finances. And I said, excuse me, you may think and your accounting system may be telling you Google's doing that. Google is not only eating your lunch, they're eating your breakfast and your dinner. Mm. And it's making enormous profits, but they don't, you know, people tell me all the time, well, you know, where do you get your news? I get my news from Google. You don't get any news from Google. There's no newsroom at Google.
Some stats came out from the Bureau of Labor. California has over 24,000 public relations positions and about 3,490 reporter positions.
Yes. The ratio has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. In one of my books, I wrote about a reporter who was absolutely right on what he was writing about. And every story he wrote, 11 different PR executives would call various people at the paper and the paper's owners to complain about him because he knew what he was doing, and it was the information that company didn't want out. I mean, AT&T had a vice president whose only job was to harass David Lazarus when he was the Chronicle's consumer writer. I mean, think about that. One, just to give him a hard time, never could show anything wasn't true. It's just we don't want to see this stuff. And more you're going to get official news from companies, and their version of events. Hey, Apple, we just paid $38 billion in taxes. Not true.
Mm. Well, what changes would you like to see, David? I mean, people like John Nichols say that what we need is, of course, this would, it's just a pipe dream, but a government-funded media where you pay tax dollars, it goes into a fund, and then things like DC Report would be funded.
They do that in Norway. They do it at the BBC. They do it in Canada. There are problems with it. PBS is partly government-funded, and PBS is extraordinarily cautious. Every time when I was interviewed by them that I mentioned Donald Trump's deep criminal connections, particularly to the international cocaine trafficker he was in bed with up to his eyeballs for years and did favors for, they cut it out. And they finally told me when they said, don't bring up anything about Donald Trump and the mafia or criminals because we're not going to run it.
Hmm.
And I understand, you know, their position, and they can edit me any way they want, but, you know, Congress will beat them up for this. And I don't know the solution to this problem. News is expensive, okay? I once spent, in today's money, $25,000 of the LA Times money on one paragraph in an investigative piece to tie down this one fact that I didn't think was that important. I would have killed the paragraph. No, 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 we have to have this. It was, at the time, $10,000, $25 today.
What was it about?
It was about the scandal of these thrift stores, you know, where you send in your clothing and then the charity says, look at all we're doing. Well, the people who run the thrift stores, somebody says, go clean out grandma's house. And they say, oh, a brown desk, $25, and they buy it for themselves. And you find out it's a Louis XIV $25,000 desk and a whole bunch of other, you know, scandalous stuff. But journalism is very expensive. When reporters fly with the president, they get charged twice first-class airfare. Twice. The New York Times had to spend, I was spending something like $5 million a year on its Iraq bureau at one point, and they had to buy armored vehicles that cost a couple million dollars each just so the reporters could move around. And horrendously expensive stuff to do. Yeah, it's very cheap, by the way, to say, the police say some guy shot his wife last night. Just watch the nightly news. It's cheap.
Mm. David K. Johnson is author of the new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David has been covering Donald Trump since 1988. We have a question from Jerome in Alameda who says, as more and more people get on board with the prospect of impeachment, many people simply back down by saying Mike Pence is worse. What do you think of that rationale?
Well, if I was a woman, I'd be particularly worried about Mike Pence. Pence has told friends of his, according to a number of news reports, that he believes that God has put him in the position he is in. Boy, that should be very troubling to people. Here's the constitutional crisis we're going to face. If the Democrats take control of Congress, they will move to impeach Donald Trump. They will hold public hearings, and there will hopefully, and there will be a better understanding by more Americans of why this matters, just as there was in Watergate. But if the Congress removes Trump because of Russian interference, and there was a clear conspiracy with the Russians, then can you allow Mike Pence to be president because he's the beneficiary of Russian interference? And if you don't, and Nancy Pelosi is speaker, then some people are going to say President Nancy Pelosi is a lawful coup d'etat. And I believe she would have to say, look, I'm a caretaker. I will not be involved in the election. I will not run for office. You know, otherwise, you're going to have real trouble. You could have violence in the streets over this. So, there is no good ending to the Trump story. We'll endure. We'll get past, even if he serves two full terms. And don't discount the possibility he'll win again. And we'll get past this. But the end for Trump, if he's impeached, he'll go around the country fomenting violence and revolution. Well, how do we know that? Because what did he do during the campaign, Rose? Mm. He said, beat that guy up. You know, beat him up. I'll pay your legal bills, which he would never do. Well, when he's not looking for votes, you think he'd hesitate for a minute to say the U.S. government is a criminal organization that's run by Sharia-seeking law Democrats and corrupt journalists and you know, we need to, you know, act.
Well, thank you for the email. David, you just brought up Russia. We have an email from Sandy in Oakland who says Congress passed a bill to enforce sanctions against Russia, but the administration will not enforce it. How do you see all of the news coming out about Russia? What is the real story, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, there's a hilarious element to this that it turns out that the sanctions they did finally name people they're going to put sanctions on among the oligarchs, they just took a list that ran in Forbes magazine. They just cut and pasted a list out of Forbes magazine. They didn't do any real. I mean, we have lots of people employed to say, here's the oligarchs that would put pressure on Putin. In 1983, Donald Trump's Trump Tower opened at the end of the year, and it was one of only two buildings in New York where you could buy an apartment as anonymous wealth in a quality building. Everywhere else, you had to go show your tax returns and your credit report and everything else. And, you know, people would reject you because they didn't like your cat or the color of your skin, though they would not say that. And Trump allowed people to come in who didn't matter. You could say, hey, I have a company called Snow Inc. in the Cayman Islands. And, you know, it might be a ski lodge and it might be a cocaine business. He didn't care. And he charged premium prices for this. One Russian guy bought five or six apartments, and Donald went to the closing. A virtual casino, a full-blown gambling operation, ran on the floor directly below Donald's three-level apartment at the top of the building. And Donald says, I had no idea when the FBI raided the place. He has done innumerable deals that I've articulated in the past with Russians that make no economic sense. But if you compare Vladimir Putin to the people on Sand Hill Road in Palo Alto, the venture capitalists, you get pitched 1,000 deals, you fund 100, 95 go broke, four of them make up for the 95, and then you hit one grand slam home run, you know, Google or Amazon. Donald is Vladimir Putin's one. And we know that they were conspiring, don't say colluding, with the Russians, because go and on the internet and read Rob Goldstone's email to Don Jr. And the fourth paragraph, I think it is, says, as part of Russia's efforts to help. Now, that is not a, hi, would you like to go out on a date? That's like, hey, you want to get together Tuesday at 6? Because we got something new. They were working together before this. And it's very unfortunate the news coverage was not focused on that language that told you they were already conspiring with the Russians. Donald, and let me be clear, Donald Trump is not a loyal American.
David K. Johnston is author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Where do you think this is going?
I don't know. We're going to find out in November. You know, if by all historical standards, there should be a swing to the Democrats taking the House, and given how narrow the range is in the Senate, even though it's the map doesn't look good for the Democrats should take the Senate. But they may not. And, you know, the Democrats stood by and did nothing. Well, all sorts of laws all over the country were passed over 40 years by the Republicans to suppress votes, to gerrymander districts. They hired all sorts of people to do all sorts of intensive mathematical work. And, you know, the Democrats sat around twiddling their thumbs, in essence. Right now, we're going to find out in a couple of days how fundraising is going. But earlier, you would think that the Democratic National Committee would be rolling in money and the Republicans would be in trouble. Exact opposite.
Well, the Kochs recently said there was a lot of reporting about how they are planning to spend $400 million in the midterm elections.
Yeah, well, let's have a government of, by, and for the Koch brothers. Mm.
We have an email from Tom who says, Paul Ryan has talked about overhauling Medicare. Will the Republican majority in Congress pass a Medicare overhaul? Rubio has talked about cutting spending on Social Security. Do you think that they're likely to go after those programs?
Well, this goes to the genius of the tax cut for most people. So you're going to get 10, 20, 40 bucks a week more in your paycheck now. But they've made it very clear that the way they're going to finance this down the road is they're going to go after Medicare, Medicaid, the biggest health care program. Orrin Hatch, who was the original sponsor with Ted Kennedy of CHIP, said right after they passed the tax bill, you know, why haven't we passed CHIP? It's now been funded for 6 years, but why haven't we passed CHIP, children's health insurance program? He said, there's no money. So we're going to borrow money so that billionaires can pay less in taxes, but we're going to have children die. This is evil. This is evil. This is the very face right in front of us of evil. And we need to recognize that we have people who are – these are not matters of political disagreement. You know, these are matters of you either are a peopleist or a corporatist. Mm. And if you love money more than people, hey, we're going down that road right now. You should be happy.
We have time for a few more calls. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Thank you. A couple of questions, maybe a comment. One is, for those people who think that we still have a democracy, I would just check out what the Democrats and Republicans have been doing in Washington for the last 20 or 30 years. But the more important issue for me is this. It's not that I'm unconcerned about what may or may not have happened with the Russians on the election, et cetera. But I'll tell you, quite frankly, as someone who tries to stay up on this, I can't speak for every American resident or citizen, but my feeling is that that may be of some interest to them, but I can tell you quite frankly that what would be more interest to me, and more interest I think to most Americans, would be the connections that Trump has financially, either with the Russians or his chicanery or whatever has been going on with his finances for the last 20 years. It seems to me that that's where people, if that was focused on more, and the Democrats haven't really focused on that. Mm-hmm. They tried to impeach him, but they tried to get him on some weird, the Democrats in the House who tried that, try to get him on some strange thing. But they weren't worried about the emoluments clause, both the foreign and domestic.
So, Greg, if you read my previous book, The Making of Donald Trump, I'll tell you a lot about his finances. I'm the guy who got his tax return, the two pages. And if you read the current book, you'll read about the emoluments clause and how Trump is setting up a kleptocracy, and in ways that you should be able to articulate to people who are uncertain about what's really going on here.
You write that he's using his properties to enrich various families. You write about Mar-a-Lago and how the fee to join Mar-a-Lago doubled to about $200,000.
Right.
And any foreign government contractors, corporations that now want to do business will stay at the Trump hotels.
That's right. And basically, on the day of the inauguration, Trump stopped the beast, the presidential limousine. The TV camera didn't move. The Trump family got out and took a two-minute turn on the sidewalk. Not one television network pointed out where they stopped. They stopped in front of the Trump hotel. And to any foreign government, any industry group, anybody who's sophisticated and wants favors, they got the message. You want something from this government, you will pay tribute to Donald Trump. Flat out improper, violation of the Emoluments Clause, grounds to remove him from office, and nothing's happened.
And then, as you point out, he is also staying at his own hotels with massive numbers of staff, and they're paying high dollar for
top
rooms,
retail,
food, and we're paying
golf
for,
carts,
and we're paying
for
all that.
And local state governments are, and the Domestic Emoluments Clause specifically prohibits state and local governments from putting money in the president's pocket. So, who's next?
Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wonder if you saw the thing, you know, where Steele, or not Steele, but his partner testified to the Senate committee.
Yeah, Glenn Simpson.
Yeah, right. And Feinstein released the transcript. And in it, his partner had said that he's not, after reading a story in the New York Times where the FBI told the New York Times that there's nothing on Russia and Trump, that Steele said that he's not going to work with the FBI anymore. He doesn't trust
right.
them.
Right.
And then right after that, Comey comes out and says 10 days before the election that, to reopen the email investigation of Clinton. It almost sounds like there was a huge contingent in the FBI that was pulling for Trump. At least that's what Steele
thought. Yeah, I understand Steele thinks that. I've actually talked to Glenn, whom I know, about this. Christopher Steele is a very highly respected British agent. He was the head of their Russian counterintelligence operations. That's how I thought he is. And I think the Times got played on that story. There's been a lot of criticism within journalism on that story, so I'd be a little cautious about that. But clearly there's a real problem here about the efforts to suppress the FBI investigation.
Well, thank you, Bill. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. We'll be joined by Scott Horton of Harper's and I believe a reporter from McClatchy who will specifically be talking about that memo. So thanks for calling. We've got a couple minutes left, David. You know, we always end the show by saying, what can people do?
Right.
Right? And everyone says vote, call your congressperson. But
well,
really,
first of all, at DC Report, whenever we can, we publish something called an action box. And we say, call Scott Pruitt, and here's the phone number, or call this or that person, or write a letter. We don't tell you what to say, and I'm sure there are people who use our information to say, keep going. That's fine. I want people engaged in our government. And so one thing you can do that's very simple is always talk about our government, our Constitution, our subordinate employee, Donald Trump. And yes, register to vote, get other people registered, arrange your life now so that on election day you can go somewhere where there's a possibility of electing a better congressperson and spend the day driving people to the polls or doing other work to get the vote out. And, you know, hopefully read my book because it will tell you what is not in the news about what is being done to you and your family, to your income. If you haven't heard of the RCEP, if that those four letters, RCEP, don't mean anything to you, you really need to read my book because it's going to be powerfully important to the future of America.
What does RECP stand for?
RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, when Donald killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, as you know, I was a big critic of, didn't want to kill it, wanted to fix it, and left a vacuum. China stepped forward with its own trade plan for the Pacific plus India. And even Australia, our lapdog ally, Australia, is beginning to pivot away from Washington and to Beijing. Nobody has done more to advance the economic, cultural, political ambitions of China than Donald Trump.
And how does that affect people's lives?
Well, if there are big trade deals, there was also one between Japan and Europe, and we're not involved in those trade deals, we get left behind. We get less favorable terms when we are doing trade deals. We don't export as much. We will import more. I mean, all sorts of bad things flow out of this. And why would we allow China to just blithely step forward? Its emissaries are going around telling these countries, look, America's in decline. Look who's in the American White House. We're the country with stable, sober, intelligent, educated leadership. You want a prosperous future, you come into our sphere and step away as much as you can from America's.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He is the founder of DC Report, a nonprofit news service focusing on what politicians do rather than what they say. And he's the author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6:30, 110 The Embarcadero. You might want to call them to find out if tickets are available, but I'm sure that they will live stream the show. David, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about the violence and devastation in Afghanistan, and we will also talk about the FISA memo. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you missed any of our past shows, you can find them at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.